Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara e sodavanta pamunjantu satang. So this is the opportunity to reflect on Dhamma the way it is. And this is in this tradition called Magga Puja Day, when 1,250 arhants assembled to pay respect to the Lord Buddha spontaneously. They didn't have internet, cell phones, or anything like that. Spontaneous recognition, enlightened master. So 1,250 arahants. I suppose you might consider that a lot of arahants. And how you define the word arahant. But it's one of the major celebration days in the Theravada tradition, when many of the disciples of various teachers assemble, pay respect to their teachers, their monks that they look to for Dhamma teaching. So, enlightenment, these words, arahant, enlightenment, nibbana, nirodha, these are all, like enlightenment is an English word, and so we use it as, well, what do you really mean by that? And then we think of a perfected human individual, or somebody that's very wise, high up, and liberated from all delusions. So that's what I've just assumed, that the most people, when they hear that word, think of it in such superlative terms. And then arahant is a Pali word, so that is the summum bonum of achievement as a meditator. You can't do better than become an arahant. And so the word itself becomes something very high up. And so when we think about, just speaking for myself as a ordinary human being, when I thought of the word arahant, I thought of it as the highest attainment or achievement. But then the personality that I would identify with, I was always seeing things in terms of far away, the bliss of nibbana, enlightenment, arahantship as something so high up, and that the personality never sees me as, I can't think of myself as a person that's enlightened or an arahant. Personality won't go there, because the personality is a condition. It's conditioned to be critical, you know, to see ourselves in terms of very high moral principles of obeying all the laws, keeping the rules, becoming a very wise person. Nibbana is, you know, because someone, a sage in Thailand, defined it once or described it once as cooling off, which put it in more mundane terms, a cooling off. Like when you boil rice and you let it cool off, you're letting the rice attain nibbana. So that's an interesting reflection on the word itself. Because as an attainment, you think, how does that apply to rice and temperature? And then as a person, the person thinks of attaining enlightenment to be one of the 1,250 arahants to join the club, and that's, as a person, the personality, the sakya-ditti, or the ego, unless it's very narcissistic, you know, how many of you all have narcissistic egos thinking you're better than everyone else? But especially in Western civilization, where we're brought up to think of ourselves as sinners, as basically we've got to please a deity, a supreme deity of some sort, and if we don't please that deity, we have to suffer for our sins. So this is, whether you're Christian or Jewish or atheist, this is very much the general cultural condition that pervades the Western culture. So one of my very favorite quote from the Pali scriptures is called, "There is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned." And if there was not the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there would be no escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. So this to me resonated a lot, because I realized that my personality is born, created, formed, and conditioned. I realized years ago that my body was born, created, formed, and conditioned. And then I thought, you know, and how can you perfect a human body? You know, just as you try to be on a special diet and take vitamins and protein and exercise and go to all the extreme measures to maintain physical health, it still gets old and subject to illness and death. So then the unborn, now this is a statement of certainty. When the Buddha says Ati Bhikkhave, he said, "Bhikkhus, there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned." Now that's a statement, not a theory. It's not a metaphysical theory. He didn't say, I think there's something called the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. It's very certain. Ati Bhikkhave, there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And if there was not, there'd be no escape from these changing conditions, from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. Now this is, you know, I even have a calligraphic painting in my kuti of this teaching, because I always like to reflect on it. It's in the Nibbana Sutta. So then I used to just reflect on the born, the created, the forming. I can create all kinds of forms in my mind. I can imagine beauty, ugly, big, small, high, low, all different colors. So the born, the created, the form, the condition is very much the thinking mind, because that's what it does, isn't it? You start thinking, and you can fantasize. You can think all kinds of nonsense. You can be very logical and reasonable. But thinking is born, created, and formed and conditioned, thinking itself. So when I reflected on this, I thought, I can't trust thinking, because it is something that is very impermanent and created. It's not the unborn. It's not enlightenment. It's not something that is absolute reality. So just by reflecting in this way and seeing how the ego, the sense of a separate self, is very much conditioned. You know, living in a community like this, a Sangha community, where we live in as a kind of community of friends, of monastics, we still realize that each one of us is different on a personal level. Even the same age or the same nationality or the same gender, just try to find another man or woman who thinks exactly or exactly like you are, like you think, like you feel. And you can't do it, because the born, the created, the formed condition is impermanent and unsatisfactory. So this is a very direct teaching. When I try to imagine the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, just watching my mind, I used to experiment on this, just try to imagine unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, and you can't do it. Impossible. And your mind goes quite empty, because it doesn't, that has no way of dealing with the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. When we think of Nibbana or enlightenment, we tend to think of it as, and we imagine it as some kind of superlative form or state, a state that is perfect. So, you know, you can create illusions of perfection, and heaven is where everybody's youthful, happy, and everything's beautiful, and hell is where everything is miserable, painful, and ugly. That's imagination. You imagine that. If you didn't have a vocabulary, you couldn't imagine heaven or hell. So just trying to make an image, a fantasy image or some kind of abstract image, or with my thinking mind about Nibbana, about the unborn, I can't do it. Because this is just to prove the limitation of words, language. They're meant for forms, for the born, the created, the form, the condition. And they're very good at that. I mean, we intellectually we can be very reasonable on the thinking mind. We can be very logical and reasonable using thought in patterns that are logical, make sense. Or we can think in mad states where the mind just imagines anything, the fear, the paranoia, the anxiety that is not rational. So when we think of fear and monsters and alien forces and ghosts and devils, that's all created imagery of what we don't want and don't like. So that's imagination. But try to imagine, put any of the qualities of heaven or hell into the unborn, uncreated, and try to imagine it. You can't do it. But with the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there's still conscious awareness. You don't just blank out into a zombie. You're fully here and now. So these are experiments I used to enjoy doing in my meditation life, just to experiment. Because I always liked this Ati Bhikkhave style in the Pali Canon, like it's certainty. It's not, you know, imagining or supposing. It's not supposition. It's not some kind of high-minded thinking. It's not metaphysical. It's not spiritual. It's not anything that you can define. It's not Buddhist or Christian or Muslim. But it's here and now, timeless. So this reflection is to encourage this kind of experiment, investigate. And that's one of the reasons why many of us become Buddhists, because even though it's called a religion, religion usually to most of us means belief in some kind of superior being or deity or creator. So there's a lot of atheists who believe there's no God, no nothing other than just existence is like this, which is getting near. Atheism is not far away, but it's still a denial. It's still taking words and denying the existence of God and supposing there isn't any God. You suppose that's just a myth. It's an imagination made up by various people. So that's not untrue, but theistic religions tend to be beliefs that we acquire. So believing is believing in the words or the statements or the scriptures or the Bible or the teachings, and so without question, without investigation or examination. But then, can you equate God to the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned? You know, because I began to realize that religions are actually, all of them, pointing toward that, towards the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. So they call that God or Allah or Yahweh or you know, it's they want to name it and believe it is a form, like a superlative form that created everything, and then we give it attributes like love and compassion, or it's a judgmental form, like a judgmental father, a patriarch that is very punishing and critical if you commit a sin. So these are all images we create with thinking. So can you really trust thinking, whether it's denying the existence of God or affirming it? It's still thinking. Because the unborn, uncreated, unconditioned is here and now. So it's not, you know, when we think of deities, we always think of them as very high above us. They're high up in the sky. And then we think of ourselves as earthbound forms subjected to gravity, to hunger, to survival. So, you know, just to be the witness to how you observe yourself as a individual form. Are you really, this is your true nature, the individual form? Because it's impermanent, it's unsatisfying. No matter how much you try to convince yourself that it is, it's not. It has moments of beauty and pleasure and excitement and so forth, but also has its opposite. We can be very caught in negative thinking and in depressions, in fears, in paranoia, stuck in these kind of states that are created that we don't investigate. We become attached to, we become obsessed with our own creations, our fears, our anxieties, our sense of separateness, loneliness. Being a separate form is also very lonely. You know, why do we seek company, friends, society, parties, go to sports events, symphonies or rock concerts, to be with others where you're kind of focused on something you're all supposedly enjoying? Family life, you know, have a family and children and parents and relatives and friends. Because without that, if we didn't have any social experience, then we become increasingly isolated and alone. And that's true. You become, if you lock yourself up in a room and don't talk or speak to anybody, then you know, you do. You begin to feel this loneliness. And I remember during the year I was a Samanera, I was the first 3 days in the Kuti, I was all alone and I was enjoying just being alone for the first time in my life, where I was just in this forest in Thailand, in this Kuti, and I really kind of indulged in the pleasure of being alone for about 3 or 4 days. But it didn't last. Just this sense of we wake or separateness by seeking, you know, solitude is a nice idea. When you're caught in the family life or business life or sangha life, then this idea of being alone and solitude sounds very nice. So, but then when you're alone, what happens? So observing that, observing how I began to miss friends, want somebody to talk to, wanting a radio to listen to the news, anything but just being alone with myself in a kuti, in a country whose language I couldn't speak, and nobody in the monastery I was in could speak English. So I didn't have any so-called friends that I can relate to. And how do you feel? How would I feel? You know, so I became aware of that, of how lonely I felt. And how boring it is to be alone with nothing to do. I was, before I ordained, my first meditation lessons were in Bangkok at Wat Ma Thot, and they taught this Mahasi Sayadaw method, which you do everything in exaggerated slow motion. So I tried to do that, just be very mindful of every step I made when I was doing walking meditation, or when I was sitting, you know, mindful of the breath of each inhalation, exhalation. I could do it for at most an hour, but then the mind would wander. And then doing everything in slow motion, you know, I had the idea I had to live my life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in slow motion, which I realized was impossible. Also, a lot of repressed emotions started arising. And a lot of really anger that I'd repressed my life, my previous life. And so I tried to suppress it through concentrating on my breath, anapanasati, and just trying to ignore it. But eventually, it just became utterly impossible to just suppress 31, 32 years of repressed anger. And as a person, I didn't want to be angry. I wanted to be kind, and I thought being a samanera, a Buddhist monk in Thailand, being full of compassion, loving kindness, is was the ideal I had, what I wanted to be like. And instead, I'm here in this kuti, this meditation hut, feeling angry over nothing, because nobody was making me angry. It wasn't because there were people treating me badly. It was just having to remember things, being impatient with memories and unpleasant memories that I'd keep trying to suppress, trying to get samadhi, trying to concentrate on an object that where I could suppress my emotions, unwanted emotions. So then I realized that in lay life, I had all kinds of escapes for avoiding unpleasant mental states. I used to indulge in cigarette smoking. I liked smoking. I liked alcohol, and all kinds of, and I read a lot of books. I was a bookworm. I had friends, go to parties, go on adventures, have romantic affairs, all kinds of things that I could, you know, find exciting or interesting for a short while. But how many interesting books can you read? How many love affairs can you have without them become boring? How many parties can you attend without getting bored with them? You realize how boring life is on the born, the created, the form, the condition. But the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned seems boring at first because the personality wants romance, adventure, excitement. It doesn't want silence or stability. It wants, you know, we used to go to these amusement parks where you go on all kinds of, like, roller coasters and machines that swing you around, turn you upside down. As a child, I used to love to go to these amusement parks. It's exciting to go on a roller coaster. So excitement is, but how long can that last? You know, how can you sustain that kind of excitement? Or you have to keep, you don't want to keep repeating the same experience over and over because it becomes boring. So reflecting on the way it is, I learned somehow or other during that time as a samanera, I couldn't do anything. There was a Thai samanera that would bring me a meal every day. That was something I lived for, to get the meal every day. And then one year, and this is in 1966, Nong Khai flooded, the Mekong River flooded the town of Nong Khai, and the whole town was inundated underwater, about 9 feet high. And the what I was living at was on a hillock outside the town. So the townspeople had congregated outside my kuti, the refugees from the town. And that day I didn't get any food. You know, so I was looking, what are these people doing outside my kuti? And then I kept waiting for the time when the samanera would bring food, and it didn't come. And I had all kinds of mental states of anxiety, how am I, you know, what to do. So this is like, I learned to just sit and observe. I would sit for hours and just observe. And that's what I encourage you all to learn to do, to appreciate, is to sit with boredom, impatience, with unpleasant, unwanted mental states, and watch them, be the witness. You can witness them. They are what they are, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, they come and go. And then the pleasant mental states, you want to hold on to. You'd like to sustain the first few years of monastic life. When I was training with Lungpo Cha, I used to be so bored sitting there without listening to the Lungpo Cha speaking Thai, which I didn't understand, and suddenly just become so bored, wanting to leave. Just listening to somebody talking and wishing they'd shut up and stop talking and let me go. So So these kind of mental states, witnessing to them. And this was, according to Ajahn Chah's encouragement, he knew I couldn't understand what was going on. He spoke in a dialect of Lao language. And when I asked to be excused from these long desanas, these long expositions, he said, no, you have to stay and endure. So I did trust him. I realized he was a very wise human being, so I even though that's exactly what I didn't want to hear, I obeyed. I followed his teaching and learned to sit through and observe, be the witness. I had a lot of insight being the witness to boredom. Because life without romance, adventure, and excitement is boring. The same thing every day, the same routine every day. Even for lay life, just the same boring routine of getting up, washing, preparing breakfast, washing the dishes, going to work, riding on the underground, and every day is a routine. It gets boring because conditioned phenomena is very nature is boring. It has highs and lows, peaks and depths and dimensions, as forms, and those forms are unstable. They have no permanent stability to sustain themselves. So by being the witness to this, you begin to question, who is this witness? If I can witness boredom, is the witness bored? If I objectify boredom as a experience I'm having in the present moment, is the witness bored, or is that a mental state that arises according to conditions? And so by investigating this and questioning, you know, is this witness, is it bored, or does it get angry, or is it happy or miserable? You know, when there's just this observing witness, the Puto, the Buddha, observing Dhamma the way it is, then, you know, I began to see when I think of it, I'm so bored, I can't stand this, I want out, I could witness that. Just by intentionally thinking it. So I intentionally think, I'm bored, I want to leave. And I realized that the words themselves, you know, were very impermanent and were created by me, who identified with my thinking mind. I strongly identified with my thinking abilities, with my intellect. So I was very attached to that, seeing myself in certain ways and trying to define myself as a person. But in the witness position, you know, all the kind of identities you might have about yourself come and go and change. And I became increasingly aware of what didn't come and go and change, that the witness never gets bored or angry or frightened. But the mental states, the emotions, the memories, the physical experiences, pleasure, pain through the senses, through the body, they're very impermanent, unstable conditions. But is the witness, is it unstable? So then I thought, well, when I'm asleep, there's no witness. You just kind of pass out, and you want to go into deep sleep where there's no dreaming. Then there's the dreaming state, the deep sleep state, and the dreaming state is kind of images, no longer governed by reason or logic, because oftentimes dreams make no sense at all. Now, they're not reasonable or logical, but they do come and go and change when you believe that you're asleep. But does consciousness sleep when you're in deep sleep, where you're not dreaming, where it's timeless? You have no sense of time in deep sleep, no images. But you can't remember that. You can kind of know after you wake up that you were in deep sleep, but you can't imagine deep sleep where there are no images, no thoughts, no feelings. And yet in deep sleep, there's still consciousness. You don't die. The body doesn't die, or the senses don't kind of dissolve into nothingness. So you realize consciousness is deathless. It has no beginning or end, has no features. It's not personal. And that's what, in the Pali word, anatta, no self. It's not a person. But it's where you realize nibbana, realize enlightenment, within the limited form that you identify with. You begin to let go of these identifications. You don't get rid of them. You're not trying to destroy anything. But you're kind of learning that what you're not. You're not the forms. You're not the senses. You're not the thoughts. You're not the memories. You're not the personality. You're not a man or woman. You're not black or white. You know, none of these matter in awareness. They lose their kind of strong effect on us, well, like racial views or religious views. They disappear into nothingness if you let them. But what doesn't disappear, and in this form, we're experiencing consciousness that is non-personal, but then out of ignorance of that, by identifying with what we're not, we never notice it. It's silent, it doesn't have a language. It's not exciting. is not romantic. But it is liberation. It's enlightenment, freedom from delusion, freedom from fear, freedom from all the prejudices, biases, problems, personal problems, social problems that we have to experience through the forms. So the forms are experience that is very impermanent, where consciousness is not an experience, it's ultimate reality. But we identify with the experiences, like memories of the past, plans for the future, hopes and fears about the future. And we don't know what we're doing. We're lost in these illusions that we're strongly conditioned to attach to and believe in. So the Buddha Dhamma is it really a religion? Or one definition of the Latin word religio really means not a belief in something, but a connection to ultimate reality, to God or Nibbana, whatever name you want to give it. It connects you, like that's what religions are trying to do, connect you to awaken you to ultimate reality, which is here and now, not something far away, high up, that you can't realize. Because the First Noble Truth is the most banal, ordinary truth that anyone could think of. There is suffering. That's a statement. And that's undeniable, you know, there is suffering. We experience suffering all the time, when we're born, when growing up, getting old and getting sick, fear of death, losing our loved ones. Isn't it? We all have this kind of sadness to life, a pathos that we experience because life is basically a sad experience. And in monastic life, we reflect that, I remember, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I think that's really depressing, sad, you know. I like to think, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will be mine forevermore. Beautiful, beloved and pleasing. And that's just wishful thinking, because that's not Dhamma, that's not the way things are. So in this realm that we're experiencing through these forms, the Buddha actually pointed a way to use the forms with wisdom to encourage us to let go of these identities, these beliefs. It's not like getting rid of, it's not a destruction of your personality, it's not trying to change your personality or make judgments about you as a person, as a monk or a nun or a lay person. It's not about anything like that. It's about just letting go of and being the puto, the here and now witness to the way it is. So the Buddha, after his enlightenment, he said to his five friends in Saranat, when he gave his first sermon, he said, there is suffering. And that is a statement. There is suffering, and it has causes. And it begins and ends. Suffering is not, it's not a statement that everything is miserable and suffering. It's not a kind of negation of life, but it's pointing to what we experience in life. The loss of youth, the loss of beauty, the loss of money, of power, loss of our parents, loss of our friends, loss of our health. These are all sad experiences. And if we grasp them, then we suffer. We're going to suffer from them because we want all that is mind, beloved, and pleasing to be stable and permanent for the forevermore, we can say, whatever that means. So patient endurance is an absolute necessity, a condition sine qua non for this life, to be able to just patiently be the witness, endure through boredom or miserable states or doubts or fears. That's where you gain the wisdom. When you're really in a terrible state and you suffer through it and you witness it and you endure through it rather than committing suicide, getting drunk, changing the radio station, the television program. So the Four Noble Truths, the statement, there's suffering, there's the causes. So it's very, very clearly explained. Four Noble Truths is an absolutely brilliant teaching. But it's not a belief. It's not about believing in suffering or because the Buddha said there is suffering, we believe in suffering. We suffer. Just the ordinary suffering that we experience daily is enough for enlightenment. It will take us to Nibbana if we're patient and willing to endure through the unpleasantness of the forms that we identify with. So I offer this as a reflection.